Chapter 19, The Dedication. May the word spoken in this sacred temple, dedicated to the ever-present God, mingle with the joy of angels and rehearse your heart's holy intents. Mary Baker Eddy, 1894. Mrs. Eddy's words to Mr. Bates, that had the Mother Church not been finished on time, it would have been a monument to error, were not understood by the scientists at that time, and they are little understood today. But she was victorious, and this victory over error enabled her to delete two of the paragraphs from her article, Overflowing Thoughts. When this article first appeared in the December 1894 journal, the third and fourth paragraphs read, "I am not unmindful of the whisperers, the unspiritual barren minds, breathing hatred and falsehood, ignorantly or maliciously, mentally and audibly, at work on the apathetic consciences, sowing seedlings of strife, declaring in the dark, quote, Mrs. Eddy is a tyrant, and she is hurting you shockingly, words that are vain when themselves know that as masked murderers, they are seeking to blind the eyes of my students as to their teacher, the sooner to kill them morally and physically. By reason of this dernier infirmity of iniquity, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Ask your God and mine if this be so. Ask my household if such is my intent, or act towards anyone. Ask those who know me best if I counsel or devise aught that hurts another's health, morals, or prosperity. My deepest desires and daily labors go to prove that I love my enemies and would help all to gain the abiding consciousness of health, happiness, and heaven." Mrs. Eddy truly loved her enemies, which love enabled her to save her cause and her students. Only those closest to her in her household knew how the error attacked her constantly, even in the minutiae of her daily experience. They also knew that her work for the world kept her from doing much for herself. Clara Shannon was close to the leader and was aware of the harassing little problems, one of which was proper clothing. For some time, everything dressmakers made for her was spoiled, nothing fit. Clara knew this was the main reason she was not planning to attend the dedication of the Mother Church, which she greatly desired to do. Clara also knew that the Mother helped all the world, but few helped the Mother. A deep desire to help the leader prompted Clara Shannon. "So I decided that I must make the demonstration and provide a dress which she could wear to the dedication, and which would be a perfect fit. God opened the way for me to do this. Mother sent me to Boston to attend to the provision of music for the dedication service. Mother told me to go and stay with Mrs. Weller, where I went at once. I knew that Mother would have preferred a gray satin that looked like silver with pearly trimming. Mrs. Weller and I went from shop to shop until we found just what we wanted. Miss Shannon wanted, quote, to break the law of malicious mental practice, which argued that Mrs. Eddy could not get anything to wear and that no one could do things for her in the right way, end quote. With Mrs. Weller's help, she had a good start on demonstrating a dress for Mrs. Eddy when she received a telegram from the latter, which read, quote, take the next train home and bring your trunk, end quote. From then on, Clara's work for the dress was all mental work, while Mrs. Weller continued with the dressmaker, etc. While Mr. Bates was working assiduously to complete the edifice, most everyone else was preparing for the dedication. Mrs. Eddy wrote to Foster Eddy on December 10th. I would take Mrs. Stetson's singers, for she has done well for the church fund. But if Miss Lincoln wishes to attend the dedication, honor her by permitting her to go on to the platform and sing a solo, or in any other proper way. The next day she wrote to Mrs. Stetson, present my thanks to Mr. Case for his fine music. I have just written to the doctor to have your singers for the occasion when the church is dedicated. But I do not know but they will delay this for some time yet. Another message on the same day concerned the mother's room and went to the directors. Permit me to make this request relative to the mother's room, and if you think best, grant it. On the marble floor at the entrance, engrave the word mother, and on the arch above the word love. 8 days later, on Wednesday, December 19th, she sent the following instructions to the directors. Present no contribution box on dedication day. When you know the amount requisite and have received it for finishing the church building, close all contributions and give public notice thereof. Hold your services in the Mother Church, December 30th, 1894, and dedicate this church, January 6th. The Bible and Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures shall henceforth be the pastor of the Mother Church. This will tend to spiritualize thought. Personal preaching has more or less of human views grafted into it, whereas the pure word contains only the living, health-giving truth. Receiving no satisfactory response to this letter, Mrs. Eddy wrote the directors again on the 23rd of December. Dear students, there is not sufficient time now to arrange a proper program for our church services on December 30th. No one has conferred with me on the subject. I have named it to the doctor, but nothing has been given me till today, just as I was leaving, to know even if you had arranged for it yourselves. But it is quite enough to say that I alone, in consultation with the directors, was the one to have arranged so important a matter as this. Now I object to pushing into this week this muddled movement of setting up a precedent for worship in the Mother Church without the Mother, who has originated all that belongs to this new church, even knowing what your formula is. The thing must be stopped right now. I must see a program of your order of service, how you announce the reading of the Bible and the reading of Science and Health, etc., in every particular. I thought that this small rite was registered a long time ago. Was the mother's position being usurped by her adopted son? Have printed circular ready for notifying the public that only the S school will be held in the new church, December 30th. Then make arrangements for the church services according to the deed and vote on the church rule enclosed. Lovingly yours, Mother. Note well, I open my letter to say I had not read Mr. Knapp's letter through, and Mr. Fry has just brought it to me, and I see that he wrote to me on this subject. But I will send the letter because God does guide me, and so it must be needed for some purpose. The church rule will be voted on was the one making the Bible and Science and Health the pastor. The next day, while Mrs. Eddy was out on her daily drive, Mrs. Weller came to Pleasant View, bearing the precious parcel containing the new dress. She had often been there before to help out in time of need and was very dear to Mrs. Eddy. On this day, her departure did not escape the leader's watchful eye, so Mrs. Weller was called back and invited to spend the night and stay for Christmas dinner the next day, much to her delight. When Mrs. Eddy wanted to know what Mrs. Weller had brought, Clara showed her a Christmas gift from Martha, Mr. Fry, and herself, a lovely silk petticoat with quilted lining, hoping to keep the exquisitely made dress a surprise for the morning. The next morning, Christmas Day, about 6:30, when I went into Mother's room while she was still in bed, I took in the bodice on a hanger, and she sat up and looked at it in amazement. I said, "Mother, dear, this is a Christmas gift for you, and there is a skirt for it, which I will bring in." I ran to Mrs. Weller's room and asked her to help me to know that all was well and that I could do what was right. Then I took the skirt into Mother's room, and she told me to stand off by the door and hold the bodice over the skirt so that she could look at it from a distance. She said, "Where did that dress come from? Where did you get it? Who sent it?" And I replied, "It is from divine love." She said, "Clara, did you get that dress for me?" "Yes, Mother. She told me to leave it so that she could try it on while she was dressing." After a time, she rang for me, and when I went to her, she already had the dress on. She said, "Go and ask Mrs. Weller to come to me," which I immediately did. When Mrs. Weller entered the room, she told her it was a perfect fit, and it was the first time such a thing had happened to her. Mother felt that love had provided her with a dress with which to go to the dedication service of the Mother Church on January 6th, 1895. That Christmas Day, her new Scotch-Canadian disciple, Reverend William P. Mackenzie, visited the Leader and Pleasant View for the first time, and after an hour's interview, became her man for all time. As he later wrote, it was like a clansman giving allegiance in love to a chief. Neither he nor Mrs. Eddy knew how very soon he was to be called to Pleasant View again. Shortly after Christmas, Mrs. Eddy sent Clara to Boston to order a bonnet made to match the lovely new gown. It was of the same gray velvet with pearl trimming, with two small gray feathers, and when it arrived soon thereafter, proved to be most becoming and very satisfactory. In providing this beautiful gown, Clara had overcome one of the claims of malicious mental malpractice, harassing the Leader, but another phase of malicious mind, which she had not foreseen, was soon revealed to her. The opening service on Sunday morning, December 30th, was a memorable occasion, marking a great change. Judge Hannah read a letter from Mrs. Eddy, ordaining the Bible and Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, pastor of this church, to continue as long as the church is satisfied with its pastor. The auditorium was crowded, with every seat filled, and many standing. Many from outside Boston were present, including the Kimballs from Chicago. The change of pastor was received with joy, and Foster Eddy bore the happy news to Pleasant View. The field had treated Dr. Foster Eddy as the heir apparent, and the exalted position was more than he could handle. He had represented his mother and read her messages at many meetings during the past 6 years, and perhaps he planned to do the same at the dedication of the new church the next week. However that may be, an occurrence at the end of December made an indelible impression on Clara Shannon. It was probably on Sunday evening, December 30th, following the opening service for the Mother Church, that Benny was dining with his mother at Pleasant View. The latter asked Clara to bring the dress and bonnet to show the doctor as she told him all about her gift from Divine Love. Many, many years later, Clara wrote, "When I think of it, it is not easy to forget the expression on his face as he looked at her, at the dress, and at me. He was not pleased." The triumph of completing the edifice at the specified time was overshadowed by this episode and its implications. Once again, the Leader's experience was much as she had described in a letter to a student a year earlier. "Few, if one, helps me or is ever at my side to help me. Per contra, everybody is fighting like fiends over every move that I make, that God bids. Every one, I mean, who hates good, and my students leave me to meet it, as of old, alone, in the sweat of agony. I sow, they reap my sowing. I weep, they laugh. I mourn, they know not why. God grant that my precious students wake from this deep sleep of the carnal mind. Every working scientist was certain that he loved good, but was also very aware that many other scientists were influenced by animal magnetism. It is not an easy thing to know thyself, but how easy to see the mote in thy brother's eye. The leader could see the influence of animal magnetism on all of her students to a greater or lesser degree, and yearned that they might wake from this deep sleep of the carnal mind. Oh, that her son might waken to the lust for place and power that was using him. The sins of her students caused the leader great suffering. As the new year dawned upon the eager anticipation of many scientists, Clara could see what Mrs. Eddy had to meet and the consequent suffering she experienced. It seemed best not to attend the dedication service on the first Sunday in this new year, but Dr. Eddy was definitely not the one to read her dedicatory message. On New Year's Day, she called Judge Hannah and Reverend Mackenzie to Pleasant View, while she wrote William Johnson as follows: I forgot to say I shall be able to inform you tomorrow who will read my sermon on dedication day. Don't delay circulars. Print, sermon by etc. will be read. Also have children, busy bees, seated in the front pews. They will wear badges, simply, Mother's Room. I have named them in my sermon. Do not let the constant dropping change your true sense of mother. Note well, to arrange rightly and get the best reader is difficult. So it is best not to name who shall read on Sunday the scriptures or science and health. Had Hannah and Mackenzie been aware of the circumstances, one or the other might have agreed to read Mrs. Eddy's address on the following Sunday when she asked each in turn. But both the judge and the young minister turned English professor, who was in a state of dismay at seeing Mrs. Eddy look 30 years older than she had the week before, were feeling the intense strain of the situation. Neither felt equal to the task. Boston was the Athens of America, the center of culture. So Mrs. Eddy notified the directors to engage the best reader and elocutionist in the United States to read her sermon. They felt the best was a man who was engaged too far from Boston to be available. But the next best in the United States was Mrs. Henrietta Clark Bemis. She came to Pleasant View at Mrs. Eddy's invitation and read to her before reading at the four services, which stretched to five services the following Sunday. Reverend Norcross, who was preaching for the Christian Science Church in Denver, Colorado, had written to Mrs. Eddy on December 22nd. Dear teacher, leader, guide, Laus Deo, it is done. At last you begin to see the fruition of that you have worked, toiled, prayed for. The prayer in stone is accomplished. Across 2,000 miles of space, as mortal sense puts it, I send my hearty congratulations. You are fully occupied, but I thought you would willingly pause for an instant to receive this brief message of congratulation. Surely it marks an era in the blessed onward work of Christian Science. It is a most auspicious hour in your eventful career. While all rejoice, yet the Mother in Israel, alone of us all, comprehends its full significance. Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. Preface, page 7, line 8. Yours lovingly, Lanson P. Norcross. His words said more than he understood. The Mother in Israel alone comprehends. The directors felt this letter from Norcross would dispel the haze of speculation which had surrounded his departure as their pastor, so they included it in the dedication service. Their complete program was as follows. 1. Organ voluntary. 2. Laus Deo. Words by Mrs. Eddy. Music by Percival. 3. Selections from the Bible and Science and Health. 4. Silent prayer and audible repetition of Lord's Prayer with its spiritual interpretation. 5. Feed my sheep. Solo. Words by Mrs. Eddy. Music by Lyman Brackett. 6. Reading of Letter to Mrs. Eddy by Reverend Lanson P. Norcross. 7. Reading of the Sermon written by Mrs. Eddy. 8. Hymn by Congregation, Christ My Refuge. 9. Benediction. On Saturday morning, January 5th, when the printed programs arrived, the directors were astounded to see after number 5, an anthem by Henry Lincoln Case, The Lord is My Strength and Song. Mr. Johnson made a hurried trip to Concord, with the result that the anthem was deleted, although there is no record of his conversation with Mrs. Eddy. Mr. Case, the musical director for Mrs. Stetson's church in New York, had sent his composition to Mrs. Eddy, offering it as a dedicatory anthem for her church. The New York choir had been practicing it for 8 weeks, under the impression they were expected to sing it at the dedication service, but were rebuffed when they came to the Mother Church on Saturday to rehearse. Once again, the students were mentally fighting like fiends over the leader's moves. Mr. Bates, Mr. Knapp, and Mr. Johnson finally agreed that the New York choir should sing a hymn the next day instead of the anthem. By January 6th, hundreds of Christian Scientists had arrived in Boston for the dedication of the Mother Church. According to the Boston Herald, from all New England, the members of the denomination gathered. New York sent its hundreds and even from the distant states came parties of 40 and 50. Even the large auditorium, with its capacity for holding 1,400 or 1,500 persons, was hopelessly incapable of receiving this vast throng, to say nothing of the nearly 1,000 local believers. Hence the service was repeated until all who wished had heard and seen, and each of the four vast congregations filled the church to repletion. The Christian Science Journal for January had included a card from Mr. Chase, which announced that the funds were ample and no more would be received. This fact did not escape the press. One reporter wrote, "Wonders will never cease. Here is a church whose treasurer has to send out word that no sums except those already subscribed can be received." They had never heard of such a thing, and it was a history-making event. In all the annals of the children of Israel, only once before had such a thing occurred. Exodus 36. "And they spake unto Moses, saying, The people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded to make. And Moses gave commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, Let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. So the people were restrained from bringing, for the stuff they had was sufficient for all the work to make it, and too much." For many years, the press had been hostile to Christian Science and Christian Scientists. But 1895 marked a turning point. The new edifice was glowingly described in the Boston Globe. The Boston Herald published Mrs. Eddy's sermon carefully and correctly in full. Extensive and fair coverage was given to the dedication of the Mother Church. As the journal described it, they, quote, "vied one with another to give as full and correct an account of the proceedings as was practicable," end quote. The world was impressed by the beautiful new edifice. The day of persecution was being succeeded by the day of popularity. In her dedicatory sermon, Mrs. Eddy said, "No longer are we of the church militant, but of the church triumphant." But the heart of her message to her students on that day, as on this, was, "Nevertheless, there is a thought higher and deeper than the edifice, the real house in which we live and move and have our being, is Spirit, God, the eternal harmony of infinite soul." The invitation. A glorious new future lay before Christian Scientists, perhaps best expressed in Mrs. Eddy's sermon on Dedication Day in these words, "The children are destined to witness results which will eclipse Oriental dreams." This prophecy, however, did not interest scientists as much as did the new edifice. Their attitude toward this new symbol of prosperity caused Ira Knapp to write to the leader in January that some are worshiping the symbol more than the divine idea which made it possible. Augusta Stetson was as delighted as any with the new edifice, but she also felt that the treatment she and her choir had received was wrong. Mrs. Eddy's letter to her on January 9th seemed to justify this conclusion. "My dear student, I was at a loss to know what you meant by your last dispatch, or should have said, by all means do not omit that fine anthem of Mr. Case's. I had seen the first order of the day and charged Mr. Johnson to allow your choir two pieces to sing, and the Boston too, so as to be impartial. I was not shown the changed program until the dedication was over. It shocked me to see Norcross's name the only one with mine on that program, and be told that the music that was dedicated to me was excluded. 3 weeks before that occasion, I kept charging the doctor to see that malicious animal magnetism should not interfere with my order as to the music, and Miss Shannon heard me tell him and heard him say that Johnson should do as I requested. He, the doctor, never wrote or telegraphed a word to me as to program or performance. I asked the doctor to help me, but suppose he was too late, although he never notified me in any way until today how things went. Edward Bates had been too busy with the building to think about anything else, and it had taken the first 2 weeks of January before he had finished all of the final details. His wife had been called to Pleasant View several times during this busy building period, but Edward could not leave the work at hand. After it was over, he was delighted to receive an invitation from Mrs. Eddy to spend a day with her at Pleasant View. The day was January 15th, 1895, and Edward took an early train for Concord on that Tuesday morning. Mrs. Eddy was interested in every aspect of the construction and asked many questions. When they talked about the dedication service, she did not tell Mr. Bates what she wrote to her student, Caroline Frame, which is as follows. Quote, "While the students were rejoicing in the temple of our God, I was struggling at home." End quote. However, she did apprise him of an aspect of her students' neglect on that joyous day, when she said with sad countenance, quote, 6,000 of my students could be there and enjoy the services and the dedication of the church. Several members of my household went down, but I was not invited, end quote. Not invited? The mother, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, not invited to the dedication of her church? This was a shock to Mr. Bates. He had assumed that either the directors or the first members had issued a proper invitation to the one who was alone responsible for their beautiful temple, but he had been so occupied at the edifice that he had not attended any of their meetings. This oversight was something Edward could not forget, even though he and Mrs. Eddy discussed many other things during the course of the day. The February Journal did not publish Mrs. Eddy's dedicatory sermon, but announced that it was to be published in pamphlet form as soon as possible. Scientists were eager to have it, for even many of those who attended the dedication had felt that Mrs. Bemis's fine reading was without understanding. When it was published in April as Pulpit and Press, the student benefited from perusing Mrs. Eddy's sermon, and he also found an added note from her pen, stressing love. Quote, unselfish, unambitious, impartial, universal, that loves only because it is love. End quote. This note also prophesied, if the lives of Christian Scientists attest their fidelity to truth, I predict that in the 20th century, every Christian church in our land and a few in far-off lands will approximate the understanding of Christian Science sufficiently to heal the sick in His name. This was followed by over 60 pages of news clippings indicating a change of attitude by the press toward Christian Science. Two of the clippings informed the field of what Mr. and Mrs. Bates had done. The breath of America, the new world, is freedom, individualism, which culminated in science and health's teaching that, quote, God is individual, end quote. The individual businessman in America has been loudly condemned, but it was he that built America. And but for an individual businessman with his unconventional methods, the Mother Church would never have been built in 1894. Mr. Bates was accustomed to acting. He could size up a situation accurately, make a decision quickly, and follow through with appropriate action. As a result, he was a man of accomplishment. He may have expected a little appreciation from Christian Scientists for his work on the church building, but that was because he did not understand the human mind, more accurately termed malicious mind. Through sad experience, Mrs. Eddy had learned what today is called the psychology of envy, and she endeavored on the day of his visit to warn Mr. Bates of the reaction to his accomplishments. After a general conversation, she looked me straight in the eye and said, quote, Mr. Bates, are you prepared for what is to come? End quote. I could not think what she meant and asked her. She said, quote, are you prepared for the treatment you will receive? End quote. I could not imagine what she meant. I supposed that everybody would be so glad the church was built and we could hold services in our own temple, that they would rejoice with everyone who had anything to do with its construction. She went on to say, quote, you came here in answer to prayer. I prayed God for 3 months to send me a man to finish the church. He heard my prayer and sent you. and you followed my demonstration, and the church is finished. But they will hate you for helping Mother. They will shun you. They will try to ruin you morally, physically, financially, and spiritually." End quote. Of this, I had ample proof within a few weeks. Following his visit with Mrs. Eddy, Mr. Bates determined to rectify the grievous blunder they had made in not inviting the founder to the dedication of the church she had built. He composed the wording for an appropriate invitation, then took it to a jeweler for advice on a suitable setting. The jeweler designed and engraved a golden scroll and attached to it a golden key to the church. The whole was encased in a green plush casket with white silk linings. A few days later, Mrs. Bates and I went to Concord, bearing this casket in our hands, and carried it to the house. When we arrived there, Mrs. Eddy was out taking her usual drive. But we told the attendant the nature of our errand, and the casket was placed on the library table and opened and the scroll set at a proper angle for reading. The attendant asked us to sit in the parlor. When Mrs. Eddy returned from her drive, she was persuaded to go into the library to see what the newspaper later described as, quote, "probably one of the most magnificent examples of the goldsmith's art ever wrought in this country," end quote. The scroll of solid gold was 26 inches long, 9 inches wide, and an eighth of an inch thick. Mrs. Eddy was overcome by her feelings when she read the inscription. "Dear Mother, during the year 1894, a church edifice was erected at the intersection of Falmouth and Norway Streets in the city of Boston by the loving hands of 4,000 members. This edifice is built as a testimonial to truth, as revealed by divine love through you to this age. You are hereby most lovingly invited to visit and formally accept this testimonial on the 20th day of February, 1895, at high noon. The First Church of Christ Scientist at Boston, Mass. By Edward P. Bates, Caroline S. Bates. To the Reverend Mary Baker Eddy, Boston, January 6th, 1895. According to Mr. Bates's reminiscences, after a few minutes she said, "Are they here?" The attendant answered, "We were in the parlor." She said, "Invite them in." As we entered the library, Mrs. Eddy embraced Mrs. Bates and wept on her neck. Afterwards, she took me by the hand and laid her head on my shoulder and said nothing. When she recovered her composure, she went to the table and, looking at the invitation, said, quote, "That is the most beautiful thing I ever saw in my life," end quote. After a long pause, intently looking at the invitation, she said, quote, "Who wrote it? Mr. Bates?" End quote. I replied, quote, I did, end quote. She asked no more questions, but said, quote, you put me in my proper place. You seem to know who I am and what I deserve, end quote. Mr. and Mrs. Bates returned to Syracuse, but their golden scroll had not completed its mission. Mrs. Eddy sent it to be exhibited in the window of J.C. Derby's jewelry store on State Street in Concord. It was written up in the Concord newspapers, reprinted in the Boston newspapers, and very soon the Bateses were receiving hostile letters from the Boston students criticizing their action. One even stated that they had no right to invite Mrs. Eddy to the church. It is sad that an exemplary action draws such criticism, but it also sets an example and a standard. In this instance, it caused the board of directors to take a similar action and belatedly to offer their new temple to the leader and to invite her to become their permanent pastor. News clippings describing the Bates' gift and invitation, plus another telling of the director's gift and invitation, were all included in Pulpit and Press. That slim volume ended with Reverend Mrs. Eddy's reply, declining to accept their costly offering and the pastorate, but agreeing to be nominally their pastor emeritus. She wrote, quote, you ask too much when asking me to accept your grand edifice. I have more of earth now than I desire, and less of heaven. So pardon my refusal of that as a material offering. End quote. As a material offering, the invitation to accept the church edifice was essential, because it was recognition of her proper place, and her refusal was conditional. She refused it only as a material offering. She told Clara Shannon and Calvin Fry that she would reject all earthly honors and adulation, that she did not forget that the people spread their garments and palm leaves before Jesus as he rode to the temple one week, and that the next week he was crucified on Calvary. Her church, the Church of Christ, was already hers, and it was not a material edifice. It was and is the church universal and triumphant. No one could give it to her, and no one could take it away. The real dedication. The real house in which we live and move and have our being is Spirit, God, the eternal harmony of infinite soul. Our true temple is no human fabrication, but the superstructure of truth, reared on the foundation of love and pinnacled in life. Mary Baker Eddy. On the 7th of November in 1894, Mrs. Eddy had written to two of her students, what is this church to me or to you if mesmerism governs its directors, as certainly it has and is still doing? The church will not be built the year that God told them to build if they go on as now. That crisis was met and passed, and it was Mr. Bates who had met it. On the 14th of January, when the directors were at Pleasant View, Mrs. Eddy told them that but for Mr. Bates, the church would not have been built. Edward Bates was a man of action and accomplishment. If he was on the board of directors, perhaps the mesmerism that kept them from implementing the leader's orders would be broken. 2 or 3 weeks later, intending to have Bates take his place, she asked Ira Knapp to resign his directorship. But Mr. Knapp did not step down graciously, as had Captain Eastman. He was so stricken by the request that she left him in his position and asked William Johnson to resign from the board while remaining as clerk of the church. Johnson acquiesced quickly, if not happily. On the 10th of February, she wrote to Edward Bates, "If you, Mr. Bates, will take the cup and drink all of it, then I will put you on the board of Christian Science directors, and Mr. Knapp can remain on also. God will one day open his eyes to see the wisdom of my advice, for he is a good man in his way, but has not grown to see what I see." Her letters to the directors, to the clerk, and to the church continued regularly. Letters of advice, admonition, instruction, and sometimes of thanks. But she still had not seen the new edifice, and all the students in Boston were eager to have her come to see it. For them, her visit would be a day of celebration, as joyous as dedication day had been. Mrs. Eddy, on the other hand, had shunned such occasions ever since the multitudes had thronged her in Chicago in 1888. In a letter of divers instructions to her directors on the 24th of March, she added, "Many thanks for your kindness and courtesy in offering to meet me at the depot with a coach and perhaps six. But I have not seen a day that I could find time to go to Boston since the church was dedicated, although I work Sundays, too, for our cause." A very few days later, she wrote to William Mackenzie that when she visited the Mother Church, the Boston students were calculating on having a procession, chime of bells, etc., but that she had gone without shot of gun. It happened in this wise. She had written Joseph Armstrong, asking him to have an attendant on duty to open the church door and conduct some friends around for her on April 1st. On that Monday forenoon, after an early lunch, she departed for the Concord Railway Station, and in company with Clara Shannon and Calvin Fry, embarked for Boston in a private compartment of a Pullman car. An ordinary cab took them from the Boston station to the church door, where they rang the bell. The scene is best described by Clara Shannon. The door was opened by Mr. Armstrong, who was so surprised to see who it was, and gave our leader a loving, affectionate, and hearty welcome, offered her his arm, and conducted her up the stairs. He showed her which was the door opening into the auditorium and went to fetch the key of the mother's room. Mother then walked into the auditorium, and I followed and remained at the end of the church, near the door, so that if she needed anything, there was someone at hand. Our leader walked up the left side of the church, facing the reader's desk, went very slowly and at times would stand still, look up and around. This she continued to do until she reached the reader's platform and stopped at the steps leading up to it. There she knelt on the first step, and I well knew how her grateful heart was going out in thanksgiving to divine love for all the way that God led her. After some moments, she ascended the steps and stood behind the first reader's desk for some moments, then behind the second reader's desk, and looked up and around. Then descended the steps on the right side of the church and walked down the aisle, still looking around and up at each window. She then came out of the auditorium and entered her room, the mother's room. She looked at the inscription over the door and that outside the door as she entered. Then she examined all that comprises the mother's room. After that, our leader sent for those of her students who were near enough to be summoned at such short notice and gave them a glorious lesson in Christian Science. The students that Clara Shannon recalled as having been there on that memorable afternoon were Mr. and Mrs. Ira Knapp, Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Armstrong, Mr. and Mrs. Irwin Coleman, Mr. and Mrs. Edward P. Bates, Judge and Mrs. Hannah, Mr. and Mrs. Robertson, Mr. and Mrs. Dunbar, Captain and Mrs. Eastman, Mr. William B. Johnson, Mr. Stephen A. Chase, Mrs. Janet E. Weller, Miss Julia Bartlett, Dr. Foster Eddy, Mr. Thomas Hatton, Mr. James Neal, Mr. Calvin Fry, and of course, Clara Shannon. Following this meeting with her students, Mrs. Eddy had her supper, which they had brought with them from Pleasant View, in the mother's room. Later, after nearly everyone but the directors had returned to their homes, she said that she would like to see the church lighted up. When all the lights were on, our leader went into the auditorium and walked up the same aisle and again stood at the first reader's desk. At that time, there were in the auditorium Calvin A. Fry and Mr. Coleman, who had charge of the building and was one of Mrs. Eddy's early students and had not seen her for many years. Also, Dr. Foster Eddy, Mr. E. P. Bates, Jonathan N. Irving, and myself. Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Knapp came in later. After our beloved leader reached the first reader's desk, she repeated aloud first one verse of the 91st Psalm, her first words being, quote, "Because he has set his love upon me, Therefore, will I deliver him. I will set him on high, because he hath known my name. End quote. After that, she began the first verse and repeated the psalm through to the end. Then she went to the second reader's desk, and in such a pleading voice, "Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. Bread of heaven, bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more." Then there was silence, such a silence, and it seemed as if that dear voice was being echoed throughout that auditorium. None broke the sacred silence, and in memory I still hear that voice, so clear and filled with such love. Then Mother crossed the church and noticed Mr. Coleman weeping. He was sitting in the pew in front of me, with his head bowed, leaning on the pew in front of him. He was so overcome with joy and memories of the past by what he had just seen and heard. Our leader went into the pew and sat beside him, touched his shoulder, and said, "Why, brother, don't you remember in the days gone by, when we went to the hall to have our services there, how you and I had to pick up pieces of paper and bits of orange peel in order to make the room clean?" Then she reminded him of several other things which happened in those days, and telling him how different it was at this time, and how much we had to thank God for, encouraged him to look up with thanksgiving and rejoice. It touched me very deeply when she spoke to us both of some of her experiences in the early days. Her conversation brought smiles to his face, and I arose and moved away to another part of the church, while they sat and conversed together, which I knew must be a holy benediction. Again, looking all around and speaking to the others who were present, she returned to her room where she spent the night. The devoted, faithful directors of her church watched through the night in the director's room. The next day, Mrs. Eddy returned to Pleasant View. Probably all those who were fortunate enough to be present at the Mother Church on the 1st of April in 1895 would agree with Clara Shannon's conclusion. Quote, "I looked upon Mother's visit to the church as its real spiritual dedication and consecration to the cause of Christian Science." End quote.